This book is an accomplishment. Now, Mark grew up in New Jersey, and as a young man, he found himself in the Army on his way to Vietnam as a combat medic. And his particular assignment was with the 1st Air Cav Division, and he was there for an entire year, most of the time on foot in southern Vietnam and in Cambodia. Now, being a combat medic means that you are devoting yourself to the welfare of the men that you're serving with, and hopefully if trouble happens, you're there to help them with life and death. After the Army, Mark eventually gravitated towards social work, and he got a bachelor's degree in social work and spent about 10 years working in that field. Gradually, as I understand it, life began to unravel for Mark, and he was no longer able to stay employed and keep his bearings in the society that he had expected to be re-entering. And he got help from the Veterans Administration to some degree and some support. After some years, it occurred to him that he had stories to tell, and that writing might be a very good way to get his story out to the public and also to help himself. And he found the Joyner Center in Boston. The Joyner Center, which offers writing classes, and its area is war and the social consequences of war. When he found the Joyner Center gratifying, he decided to move to Massachusetts, and he eventually came to Gloucester in 2001. The writing part began to develop, but I can tell you that, well, let me back up a minute. This book I consider to have two tremendous sets of accomplishments. One is there are bits and pieces about Mark's service in the Army, and the unpremeditated accomplishments are those acts of courage and valor for which he was highly decorated in his service in the infantry. Another unpremeditated part of Mark's life there was when he was taken out of combat at the end of his tour to spend some time in a rear post, that he found that emotionally extremely difficult, to being pulled away from his buddies for many months. And he sobbed. Now, when Mark took up writing, he was not an instant brilliant literary success. I can attest to that. He had stories to tell, but that's not enough. So the premeditated accomplishment about this book is how he plugged away and learned the craft of writing. This is a literary achievement of the first order, I believe. And to conclude this introduction, I want to read three tributes to the book that when Mark circulated this to some very well-known and deeply respected members of the literary and the veterans community, that and he received back blurbs for the book. I want to read three of them to you. The first is from Doug Rawlings, who is one of the co-founders of Veterans for Peace. Levy got me with his first sentence. Anyone can say they were in Vietnam. I pay his work the ultimate compliment that I pay Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carried. The lines between fact and fiction are blurred, and that, my friends, is exactly what Vietnam was like. Read this collection. The second is from a new friend in Mark's life, Frank Serpico, whose name you may be familiar with from as a New York City undercover police officer about whom the movie Serpico was made. He writes, his writing is about the aftermath that follows you home. His words flow like poetry, exposing the carnage and madness of war, sanitized by the medical profession as PTSD. And the third tribute is from Larry Heineman, who was one of the faculty at the Joyner Center when Mark first went there to develop his writing. And Larry is the author of Paco's Story, which was the recipient of the National Book Award. Here is a fine collection by one of the Vietnam War's finest writers. His quiet voice details a variety of experiences hard to come by. The stories click with a kind of muted rage, a majestic astonishment, the fine appreciation of deep irony and unmistakable authority. Buy this book and learn a thing or two about the war that defined and baffled and energized a generation. Here's Mark.
Thank you for that introduction, and it's good to be here. I'll try to live up to what you said. So the name of the book is How Stevie Nearly Lost the War and Other Post-War Stories. And on the cover, there's a picture of Ajax and Achilles, and they're playing dice. And it's kind of a play on the title. And in the background, you have to look real careful. The background is the jungle, and it's a photograph of myself on an enemy trail. But you'd never know it, but it just fits just right. So what I thought I'd do tonight is read some excerpts from some of the stories and possibly some other stuff. We'll just see how time and energy proceed. I think I'll try sitting, and then I may want to stand. And there are a couple of copies of the book in the back. So I did a lot of traveling when I left the States in 92. And so a couple of stories are related to traveling. And the theme of the book is that the war is kind of always in the background. And rather than say PTSD, it's post-war. So this first story takes place in Guatemala. And I lived for a couple of months, like 8 months in Guatemala, in a little village called Todos Santos in the mountains of northwest Guatemala. And I did a lot of climbing in the mountains and didn't realize that was a lot like simulating going on patrol. I didn't know it. And so this story is called On Meeting Juan Pablo Lorenz. And the context is that I've just reached his house with a guy named James, another gringo who I met while I was living in this village. So we've just hiked about a mile. So we've gone from 9,000 feet to 12,000 feet. The air is kind of thin, and we're kind of tired. And here we go. We've never asked Juan Pablo why he lives at the mountaintop, why he has chosen this lonely life. The Altiplano, unlike the fertile valley, is a landscape of desolate but spectacular outcroppings and skeletal trees, which stand out against a clear sky the receding ranks of the Pastel Cuchimatanes. Here at 12,000 feet, the thin air imparts a supernatural feel to all sight and sound. A crow's wing claps like thunder. The bark of a dog is a frightful event. Bienvenido, says Juan Pablo, shooing away the excited pet. Pasen adelante, pasen. Come on in. Few people visit here, but nearly all villagers have dogs to warn of thieves. Stepping forward, we crouch to enter the low doorway of the large hut, built from timber planks, stood on end. Juan Pablo, perhaps in his 20s, is a thin, happy man, with a broad, handsome face, a half-moon smile which reveals his large white teeth. His thick black hair pokes out from a traditional straw-woven hat. His pretty young wife, Elisabetta, carries the frightened infant daughter on her back in vibrant cloth stitched with ancient Maya fabric. She hums to her child, but still it whimpers. In the center of the dirt floor, James, Juan Pablo, and I sit around a 3-stone fireplace. Behind us, in the dim light that peeks through the cracks between the upright boards, a kitten prowls through shards of broken pottery, dried chicken bones, wood shavings, newspapers, cardboard boxes. Here, an hour's walk from town, nothing is thrown out. Juan Pablo leans forward, turns his head sideways, and gently blows on the embers until the wood crackles and bursts into flames. The wood planks reflect our shivering shadows. The rising smoke exits through a small blackened hole in the roof. The fire slowly draws the chill from us. I offer gifts, bread, hard-baked cooking chocolate purchased in Antigua, a pound of unshelled peanuts, 4 tins of milk, a large felt blanket. Gracias, says Juan Pablo, but then asks, ¿por qué? I don't know why I climb so hard each day, or if I need to help this man survive. Elisabetta begins the ritual of making tortillas. She has already ground the corn in the traditional manner, wetted it into a thick white paste. In the warm hut, as her body shifts to the patter of her moistened palms, which quietly slap and press the dough into patties, the anxious child is lulled to sleep. One by one, Elisabetta sets the bread discs onto a circular pan she has placed upon the fire. One by one, she turns the tortillas over with her fingertips. In these moments of tapping palms, the padded step of the playful cat, the burning wood sliding into itself, this land of Maya dressed in brilliant patterns of clandestine graves and unbridled beauty. James is puzzled by my tears, but does not ask why I cry. And if he did, I would not be able to tell him. We say adios to Juan Pablo, goodbye to his wife, to the sleeping child, the slumbering kitten, the vigilant dog. The return trek goes well. Like the Maya on steep trails, we tilt our bodies back, taking short, hurried steps as we trot downhill. On the main, wide trail, we run in curves which absorb our momentum so we do not trip or fall or tumble over the mountain. We arrive at the village in half the time it took to reach the home of Juan Pablo Lorenz. I say goodbye to James. See you tomorrow, he says. Then he is off for a communal meal at Tres Oglitas. There are no customers at Commodore Catty's, a restaurant of 2 cement rooms furnished with simple pine tables and chairs. There are no menus. There is no music. An indigenous girl takes my order. It is always the same, a large bowl of vegetable soup, a plate of rice and chicken. Sopa de verduras, she always asks, y pollo? Sí, I say, y pollo. The girl leaves. In the dirt yard out back, there is the sound of flapping wings, scampering feet, desperate squawks and final cackles. A cut to the neck and the bird is dead. Waiting for the meal to cook, I see a small boy peering through the half-open door, I wave to him, barefoot. He wears dirty, torn clothes, a hat with a hole in it, his face a mixture of hope and fear. He stares at me. I know this child. He has often approached, then run away whenever I've climbed or descended the mountain alone. I make a welcoming gesture. The boy hesitates, then runs in and sits in the chair opposite me. What would you like? I ask. Naranja, he says, pointing to an empty bottle on a nearby table. I call to a young woman in the kitchen, lording over large kettles atop a wood-burning stove. Señorita, I say. She steps out from behind a curtain, her face and hands moist and pink. Uno more, por mi amigo, I say, pointing. The girl nods, disappears, moments later sets a new bottle on the table. The boy, perhaps 8 years old, cannot contain his excitement. I pry the metal cap off with the tip of a knife. He grasps the bottle with both hands, lifts it to his mouth, and guzzles the thick orange drink. Nothing I can do will change his plight, but for now he is happy. Tacked to the far wall is a colorful poster of Gringo Jesus, his arms held wide, palms turned upward as if to embrace the world. His parted shirt reveals a split-open chest. Bolts of yellow light streak from his red sacred heart. As the boy drinks the sugar water, as King Jesus holds his sacred smile, as the soft clink of silverware is not the biting song of bullets, the girl sets the bowl of simmering vegetables, the plate of meat and rice, on the table. The aromatic steam fills the room. The boy stares at the feast but is silent. There is much hunger in proud Todo Santos. Pollo, por mi amigo, I say to the girl. Suddenly, a middle-aged woman steps out from behind the curtain. With all her might, hurls her sandal at a skeletal dog drawn by the scent of the food. She yells at the gaunt creature. 100 glottal curses fill the air. My legs and body tremble. The boy looks at me strange. ¿Qué pasa, señor? He asks. ¿Tiene fría? ¿Por qué se agita? ¿Por qué? Are you cold? What upsets you? What's happening, little friend? No, it's not the cold mountain air or shivery chills, but the sight of the throne sandal and the sound of your last words that whisk me back in time. Enemy grenades, primitive but effective, more often maimed Americans than killed them. During the ambush, after the snap of the chemical fuse, caused by pulling a bit of string, the invisible enemy hurled the wood-handled grenade at us. It fell short, but the blast twisted the machine gun's barrel as if it were clay. Someone threw one of ours, a smooth, nasty little bomb with a killing range of 5 meters. After the blast, a sergeant thought we'd kill them all. But then a second snap, and this time the grenade landed between us, and we 5 soldiers scampered away, but not soon enough. Boom. And we lay screaming. But what can I tell you, my friend, that your families or neighbors do not know? What could I say, and how could I say it, and what difference would it make in your world? The dog yelps and scampers away. The angry woman picks up her shoe. The boy upends the bottle and drains it dry. Gracias, amigo, he says, smacking his orange-stained lips. Gracias. Then he is gone. That night, after walking the small trails to Desiderio's house, trudging up the cement staircase, after turning off the naked light bulb and laying down in my box spring bed in my square room, overlooking the fertile valley, cloaked by darkness, sheltered beneath a felt blanket, before sleep overtook me, my tears fell like rain. And then, thank you.
I'd like to ask a question now, if that's all right. So, your experience in Guatemala, I mean, so you I mean, it's clear in the poem how connected it was to your experience in Vietnam, but how did you, like, why did you choose Guatemala to go to?
Yeah, yeah. So I was working in New York, living in New York, and I became acquainted with a group called CISPIS, the Committee in Solidarity with El Salvador, and began attending their meetings, and didn't realize it, but I was identifying with the people in El Salvador who were basically surviving a U.S.-backed civil war and sustaining terrible civilian casualties. And I eventually went over to El Salvador on my own, instead of with an activist group, and that kind of gave me the traveling bug. I really liked it. And from that, I decided that I wanted to study Spanish so that I could use my social work skills to work with refugees. This is back in 86. And so I went to Guatemala after burning out in New York. My last job was with the Salvation Army. I burned out and just bought a ticket and made my way to this place called Xela Quetzaltenango. It's a dirty, dry, grim industrial city that had Spanish teaching schools. And I spent a day there and said, this isn't for me. Saw a poster for a place called Todos Santos up in the mountains, and I said, that looks good. It's a little drawing of a peasant peeking out from behind the leaves of corn. That's my style. None of this, you know, I'm surrounded by mechanics and buses and diesel fumes. This is not how to learn Spanish. So I caught a bus, and the closer we got to Todos Santos, going up, you know, getting out of the city, getting out of Huehuetenango, getting up in the mountains, it becomes more urban, it becomes more agricultural, with the trees and the timber lines and open sky and in the valleys, and I thought, this is it. And studied, and that's how it all began. So then I traveled 8 months when I was there, drifted for a year when I came back, and then left and worked a year in New Zealand, in the South Island, and the goal was to travel. So in Asia, but not Vietnam, I just blocked that out. So I traveled backpacking 8 months in Asia, and this story is about visiting Angkor Wat. And so it's an excerpt. It's called Torque at Angkor Wat. And it begins with, the excerpt begins where I'm getting off a speedboat. It's a 2-hour speedboat from Malaysia to Siem Reap, which is the town you stay at to get to Angkor Wat. And, you know, it's a speedboat full of like 40 doped out, loud, drunk tourists. So I couldn't take it. So I went up top. And there's one other gringo up on top, and it turned out he was an ex-Marine, hadn't been in combat, but we buddied up. So this starts out where we're just getting off the speedboat, and there's these Cambodian soldiers, because it was a security situation in 92. Khmer Rouge, still a problem, and here we go. It begins raining a cold, piercing rain which turns the dark earth to chill, muddy soup. The passengers, mostly young foreign backpackers freighted with too much clothing and gear, slip and slide and look for shelter. Soon they panic. Only Jack and I remain calm. We make a gallant path through the fumbling amateurs. For some reason, the frightened youth and well-armed men make way. We step with authority. We step forward as if we know this ground. The driver of the idling truck is a middle-aged man, his caramel face pitted by 100 stories that would take a lifetime to tell. He wears simple, common clothes. He wears a red and white checkered Cambodian scarf around his neck. When he speaks, I watch the rise and fall of his jugular vein, which is thick with blood. "Me take you to finest guest house," he says, through a bridge of rotted teeth. It is cold and damp inside the rusting American military truck. Jack nods his approval. I lower my chin. There is war in my mouth, and it tastes like bullets. I am silent. Then we are off. In the blinding downpour, rain pelts the windshield in thunderous beats, which make sight impossible. I expect the last-minute swerve, the grind of gears, the screech of brakes, the slow-motion fragmenting glass as our bodies pass through it. But the driver grips the wheel with one hand and repeatedly ducks his head out the side window, squinting and shaking and steering all at once. Soon he is thoroughly wet. Water drips round the sacred curve of his large Cambodian ears. It drips down the well-worn path made by his venerable cheekbones and triangular jaw. It drips into the red-white checkered scarf softly knotted around his throat. Water gathers and drifts down his lean torso, down his meager Asian hairless legs, down his delicate bare feet, until it finally pools itself onto the rotted steel floor and sinks to the flooded road beneath us. In our wild dash to the broad and narrow streets of Siem Reap, as we glide and splash through submerged roads that crest like rivers, the pulsate drip, drip, drip of solitary water beads makes me calm. Here is guest house, says our driver, pointing toward a rain-swept path. We pay with wet money and rush outside. By the time we enter the clean, dry, well-lit room, our clothes are drenched. Jack removes his shirt, seats himself in a wide yellow sofa, and busies himself in the crimp and curl of making joints. I remain standing and silent, and he thinks I'm strange. I say I'm cold and tired. I say perhaps tomorrow we'll visit Angkor Wat. Jack says sure, and I say good night. An ageless, friendly woman emerges from a glass bead door. She parts it with her hands locked in prayer. Here, key, she says, accepting money. In my large room with its square, thick bed and vault of mosquito netting, I take pills and lie down and do not recall my dreams. Before sleep, I tell myself, I am good, I am calm, I am strong. In the morning, Jack and I flag down a weather-beaten motorcycle. It is a strange sight, two large men gathering around one thin man, whose fragile machine we must commandeer to visit eternal Angkor Wat. In the banter of bargain, the gaunt Cambodian stands his ground, and we call his bluff by leaving. Okay, okay, he shouts. $5 for both. $5. A small fortune in a country where once a life could be lost for the crime of wearing glasses. We straddle the slim seat and bunched up, hold tight to flimsy belts. You ready? You ready? Yes, we shout in unison. The driver races down long, empty boulevards flanked by massive leafy trees which make the morning air bright and cool. Only the sputtering engine breaks the invisible silence. Ghosts are nearby. I know it. I can feel them. When we reach the great sprawling temple, we are dumbstruck. The long, pale building snakes across the horizon like a sideways totem spirit caught in the dream world between rest and waking. The strange organic stone palace beckons us forward. For 3 long hours, we inhabit the intricate site. Stepping like deer over the white stone floors, we honor the warrior carvings. The driver grows impatient. All right, we say, and ride to a temple where the jungle has not been slashed and burned and cleared away. This Tapram, says our driver. As we dismount, he wipes sweat from his brow and beneath his breath utters the strange words, Khmer Rouge. Jack tells him to wait by the side of the road, and we begin walking forward. I look about. Where have I seen these great twisty vines, sky-poking trees, dirt trails studded by jagged rocks cocooned in pillows of emerald moss? Where did I first hear the animate sounds of green triple canopy tranced with decay and life? I want to run. I want to hide. I want to plummet childlike into this vast room of living dreams. But the sweltering heat makes us lazy. We drink rivers of bottled water and take refuge in lichen-covered stone temples where all colors are sublime. I sit and talk with a small boy selling souvenirs. Jack takes photographs, then hunkers down and smokes a papery marijuana stick while seated bunched up like a gargoyle. Idiot, I want to say. We are guests to a lost age in sacred rooms which know the luminous voice of prayer and song. We are guests under low roofs, locked in the vice of towering trees and serpentine vines. We are surrounded by stone and light and triple-layered jungle which knows no law but its own. Idiot, I want to say. Can you not feel each living moment tick past? Can you not know what it's like to live here? What it means to rush forward to the screaming men? Idiot, I want to say, can't you taste and smell the humans veiled in billowing cordite? Can't you see the frozen man who cannot move? In the war, the living become like statues lifted by helicopters or left to decay. Silly, wasted idiot, do you not know what it's like to wake from monstrous dreams still swallowed in sprawling nightmares? See how the impartial sun fills me with fear. See how the percussive white hammer spits metal through skin. See how I freeze decades after the event. Dear stoned, wasted one, in war all suffer their fates. I am fortunate. The dead do not speak when I talk back, or judge my sins. Look at your smoking. Look at you smoking your tight-rolled reveries. What do you know? Thank you. The story goes on, and eventually we ended up playing Frisbee in this big field. And the guards, or armed guards, they were watching us. It's 120 degrees. And this guy, Jack, had a dragon tattoo across his chest, and he was built like Muhammad Ali, and he was like 31, and I was 44, and we were both really good at what we were doing. You know, like 50 yards apart, you know, speeding this thing across this field. And eventually, and he was smoking a joint, he was stoned. And some soldiers, irregular soldiers, came out of the jungle. They had like rags wrapped around their head, and they had M16s and AK-47s and B-40s. And I'm not stoned, and I am freaked out. I am freaked out. So if you want to know what happened, read the story. You did not see that coming.
The title of that story?
The title of that story is Torque at Anchor Wat. By the way, I think it's on the internet too. You just Google it and it'll come up. How are we doing for time?
Good.
Okay. I was in Nicaragua two or three times. And once I went back with a group who were medical activists. They wanted to give medical aid. So it was pharmacists, nurses, maybe a doctor or two, about 10 of us. And we went to Bluefields, which had just been hit by, I believe, Hurricane Mitch, around 89, on the Atlantic coast. It's an autonomous region, a remote, kind of wild. And the war was winding down, the war with the Contras, again, sponsored by the Americans, backed by the Americans. The Contras were against the Sandinistas. It was a great visit, and out of that visit came this story called Bluefields. So I want to read an excerpt from it. You can imagine we've been traveling, and we finally make our way to Bluefields, and we stay there a couple of days. And I'm the Vietnam... Well, the guy in the story, there's one Vietnam vet, and there's a bunch of basically normal people. And this is, I'll just read it from here. This is about a six or seven minute read. Footsteps. A man. As I turn to face him, his husky voice says, "You are the one who came up the hill. You are here for the horses, yes?" A tall, muscular, swarthy man with bronze skin, dark eyes, shoulder-length hair, he extends his calloused right hand to me. "I am Marcelino Ramirez," he says, as if he were a bridge connecting one moment to the next, as if he can see, feel, hear many things all at the same time, as if his real work in this life is to keep himself whole. I stare at the maverick patchwork of welts and scars that spangle the right side of his neck. "From the Contras," he says, without blinking. Marcelino shapes his hand pistol-like, pulls the trigger twice. I know the phrase to express sorrow, so I say it. "Lo siento, señor. Lo siento. I do know." Marcelino does not reply. Instead, after touching palms, we leave the hut, walk a short distance to a half-acre clearing. A mare and two stallions swish their tails, lift their ears, sway their heads toward us. Marcelino makes a clicking noise by repeatedly pressing the tip of his tongue to the roof of his mouth. Retracting it back, the big tan horses amble up to him like obliging children. "This one," I say, running my hands over the mane of the mare. "I'll take this one." There are no stirrups. There is no saddle, only a white plastic rope fitted for reins, which Marcelino uncoils from his pants pocket. "Gingy," he says, calming the horse as he slides the rope over her head. At the sound of her name, Gingy pokes at the earth with her right hoof. I point to the beach, pantomime riding. "Okay," says Marcelino, "1 hour, $1 American. Walking away, he points to the hut, on the table. Then he is gone. In the dream, I'm standing knee-deep in the ocean with a large black horse. The water is clear and cool. Overhead, the ribs of sun-tipped clouds fill the blue sky. I put my arm around the horse's neck. "I love you," I say. The animal flares its nostrils, snorts, shimmies, lowers its neck and head, nuzzles me. When I step back, it gallops away. Love. For one solid hour, I lay still, saturated by the rapture of this perfect word. I canter Gingy over long stretches of glistening beach, wheel her about, dig my heels into her heaving flanks. I crouch, lean forward, growl her name, growl it into her raised ears as her galloping hooves kick up sand and foaming surf. 6 times we climb the hill, 6 times we descend. On the last trip up, I dismount. The moment I release the white harness, the exhausted horse bolts, takes her place among the stallions, who whinny, ripple their necks, draw near and console her with the sides of their muzzles. "Gingy, Gingy." But there is no answer. I leave money in the hut, walk to the far end of the shoreline for an hour, listen to the murmuring waves roll and retreat, then walk to where the others have gathered. The boat will arrive soon. The blood-red sun touches the tip of the sea. There is tension here. I can feel it the closer I approach. Margaret sits cross-legged, like a monk in contemplation. At the sound of my footsteps, she straightens her back, opens her eyes. "We watched you riding," she says. Her questions do not disguise her concern. "Where did you learn to ride like that?" I kneel on the sand next to her. "What do you mean?" I say. "Do what?" They have been talking amongst themselves. Why don't they just ask it? You didn't just ride, says William. He scowls, raises one hand, points to the hill. You raced that horse. You punished it. You never let it rest. Something's bothering you, says Anne. Standing up, her brown hair falls to her shoulders in ringlets. I noticed it the first day we met. Something, I don't know. Her voice brims with feeling. What is it, Robert? Tell me. Tell me what's wrong. I want to tell them the beautiful dream of 1 year ago. I want to tell them it is not easy to live without love. Tell them my last love said late at night that I thrashed in her arms, called out names, made animal sounds, kicked and tossed, once gripped her neck so tightly she fought to wake me. I want to tell them the human voice can soar to inhuman heights when caught in the steely claws of modern or primitive weaponry. I want to tell them I have seen good men swiftly convert from sorrow to savagery, like trusted grandfather clocks gone mad, or merciful monks gone crazy. I want to apologize. Must do that. I stand up, hands flat at my sides. I look to each of them. Margaret, her narrowed face a portrait of pain. Anne, life generous, lenient. William, his furrowed widower's brow racked by discomfort. Father Allen begins to speak, but his words stop at the drone of the engines carried over the water. We scurry about, gather our things, hurry to the spot where the boat will meet us, sit quiet on the short ride back to Bluefields. We actually met the Contra. It was a predetermined meeting in a small house made of thick lumber, but dark. And they actually had to close all the windows. The war was winding down, but the Contra were hated. And so there were five of them, an officer and four soldiers, and, you know, seven or eight activists, and a lot of tension. But the activists were naive. And they're asking really kind of naive questions. Where did you do your training? And, you know, what do you have for breakfast? And, you know, what's your favorite color? You know, I mean, really crazy stuff. So I asked some pretty tough questions. And everybody got upset. They didn't say that. You could just feel it. And at one point I said, does anybody ever have nightmares? You guys ever have crying spells? You know, I just rolled out this list of PTSD stuff. And that opened it up. And this one kid, this like 19-year-old kid, he goes, you know, and he pulls out this loaded .38. And he goes, you know, I only carry this with me because you know, I don't feel safe without it. But not when I was in the war, you know, I didn't kill anybody that didn't need to be killed. I mean, so that's real. And then some guy unloaded something else. One guy worked for the CIA. Then it got real. And the captain had an incredible story. I mean, he rolls out this thing about he used to wake up in the jungle after the war and he would feel blood in his throat, his words. And he went to see his bush doctor. Talk about VA in Nicaragua. The bush doctor gave him some, like this bundle of herbs, and he said, you light this and blow it out and wave the smoke and inhale it, and that will purify you. And he's telling us this in English. He said he did that for 3 days, and he was okay. Happy story. And then it continues, and again, you know, if you want to find out how it ended. Because that one is not on the internet. It was, by the way, it was that story and the title story were edited by my friend George Dickerson, who was an actor and a novelist and an editor. And some of you may have seen the movie Blue Velvet. George was the detective who looks into the paper bag and says, yes, that is a human ear. He's a great editor, and he passed away about a year ago.
Mark, is this book on tape? Did you do books on tape?
It's not on tape, but it's on Kindle. Yeah.
Oh, okay, but it's not, we don't get to hear
Thank you, but...
we still can. I belong to Audible.com, and if you ask for a book, because yeah. I really haven't previously gotten requests, they can add those up. Like today, I got a book, but it's still not out. It's called My Wish List, and they will do it.
Okay. Okay. Do we have... We can keep rolling here. Okay. I want to do an excerpt from the title story. And this story began at the William Joyner Center, but not in the traditional way. In the traditional way would be you bring something and then it gets workshopped in class and the teacher goes over it with you and so forth. But I was sitting at breakfast one day, this is around 2004 or something, with Larry Heineman, a great writer, great storyteller, great voice. And we're just basically just talking before we're going to go to class like 8 o'clock in the morning, where he's going to be the teacher and there's 10 students. And I rolled by him this story, this true story. And he looked at me, and in his Heinemann-esque voice, he said, "Leo, that is a great story. Mark, you have got to write this down. You have..." So it took about 4 or 5 years to get it right. I finished it in Gloucester. Yeah. So this is the first 3 or 4 pages, and Larry edited the first paragraph, which I'll read, because at one point he said, "Too much, just tighten it up, and make every word count." And the last line, he said, "Make." And the last line ends, and this is Larry, "Quite some time ago." Ago, very theatrical guy. The war, Stevie is told, with its white-tailed rockets and hard crack ricochets. The war, with its thumping whirl of trembling choppers. The war, with its shirtless gun crews manning steel-wheeled cannons. The war, with its fine plumed shells cutting silver arcs through infinite sky. The war, with its lumbering tanks and sun-bleached bunkers. The war, with its steep, lush highlands, emerald lattice of checkerboard patties. The war, with its mangled torsos, triaged too late. The war, Stevie is told, on scheduled clinic days, had ended quite some time ago. Stevie sits on the bare floor in the center of his 9x9 studio apartment. It is a good thing to do. Long past midnight, seated cross-legged, facing the solitary open window opposite his computer and metal file cabinet, he leans against his white bookcase and recalls the soft patter of rain on tropical wood, the curling trickle of thin, incessant rivulets. In tropical forests, before first light, all sound felt amplified, organic. Yet nothing happened, nothing of consequence. Years later, he regretted that while angry young men wearing torn battle fatigues, unit patches, mud-slicked boonie hats, hurled their combat medals onto Capitol steps, some weeping, others shouting, yet strangely peaceful, in their rude descent, Stevie lay snug beneath an olive drab stockade blanket, thin, exhausted, hair cut close, unable to attend. Soon he will rise to make toast, the preferred meal of day or night. For now, Stevie thinks of Cindy's last letter and Cindy herself. She is short, of medium build, with auburn hair and alluring, firm calves. Of particular note is the manner in which her mouth seems to push forward, as though a permanent kiss strained her curious face. She is pretty, but not in the conventional sense. He had known her in passing, knew his curious manner did not unnerve her. She read well in public. Her writing was better than most encountered at cafe readings. When Stevie read about war, not once in 2 years did Cindy look away. Stevie remembers their only date. "Would you like to go out sometime?" "Sure," she said. The very next afternoon they walked for hours in the lush wood of a nearby state park. Toward evening they returned to Cindy's well-kept house. "You can come in," she said. "I trust you." Her home was filled with fine antique furniture, exquisitely placed. The walls were earth-toned, adorned with Audubon prints. The carpeting was soft and thick, rich with patterns of amber and blue. They sat on a plush white love seat. "This is Sasha," Cindy beamed. Stevie gently stroked the calm beige cat behind its scarred left ear. When the trustful creature tired of his touch, it jumped from his lap and scurried away. Then Stevie kissed Cindy, simply kissed her full on the mouth. His tongue wandered, his fingertips traveled beneath her red silk sweater. She pulled him, pressed herself tight against his torso, then murmured, "Do you want to?" And Stevie said, "No." Because he did not wish to fuck her like Bride would have. Sharing a foxhole, Bride regaled Stevie with prodigious stories of sexual conquest. 70 women found, fucked, forgotten. Then a single shot rang out and the burly sergeant slumped forward, dark blood gathering beneath his head. When the sniper was caught, the platoon butchered her. Stevie had held her down. "It won't work, Cindy. We'll end up hating each other. I know it," he said. He never spoke this way, polite, casual, comforting. "What do you want?" she said, straightening her clothes. She was lovely, he thought, so lovely. "Just be my friend. Will you be my friend?" When Cindy said yes, Stevie wept soft, susurrant tears. "Why are you crying, Stevie?" "I don't know," he said. "I don't know." She held him close until his time came to leave. In one seamless arc, Stevie rises and seats himself at his computer, a mongrel stitched from the wreckage of other people's lives. It is late, the perfect time to write to Cindy, who must be sleeping. Subject: memo. Date: Tuesday, 30 May. From Silver Spartan to Mimsy Pearl. The Memorial Day service went well. They played the Billy Joel song with chopper blades in the background. No caffeine in your blood, that'll wake you up. Old men read poems about duty, honor, country, that sort of thing. The crowd loved it. Then it's my turn. I tell them things they need to hear. A few vets said, "You tell it like it is, brother. Got any more?" But my head was splitting, so I left. Petra, the acupuncturist, thinks it's psychosomatic. Stuck me with 21 needles. I'll wait a few days. See my doctor. Stevie clicks send, logs off, pushes the chair back, decides to make toast. He uses his incomparable, outlandishly priced, made in Spain, NAFTA-approved, Krupp's foolproof, fucking doofus-proof, as Sergeant Bride would say, Bride shot so impeccably, deluxe, white-toned, smooth-shelled, quite nearly noiseless, two-slice toaster. Stevie twists open the plastic bread sack, daintily drops one slice into the left slot, one into the right. "Yes, sir," he says, saluting the phantom white refrigerator. "It's a wonderful toaster. It's a fucking perfect toaster. It's the most beautiful fucking toaster of all fucking time." Pressing the plastic start bar, Stevie beholds the filament rods heating to brilliant red. Six times, in tight 3-minute intervals, the caramelized shards spring up. Six times, Stevie flinches. It is a good meal, a simple meal, wolfed down in seconds. Stevie sweeps the crumbs off the kitchen counter with the ridge of his palm, then flicks off the kitchen light. When he lies down to sleep, his dreams are not pleasant. How are we doing?
You don't want to.
Got it. Thank you.
You got to buy the book.
Got it.
You want to read the whole thing.
Thank you.